the best things in life for free. If you subscribe to The Spectator, you'll get a whole month for free. And after that, you'll only pay a pound for full access to our website and to our app. And if you want to pay £2, you'll get our magazine too. To claim this offer, go to spectator.co.uk/free.
Hello and welcome to Table Talk, the Spectator's food and drink podcast. I'm Laura Prendergast.
And I'm Olivia Potts.
And today we're delighted to be joined by Philip Khoury. Philip is the head pastry chef for Harrods, which he joined in 2018, and has been busy pioneering plant-based desserts, or what he calls the last frontier of vegan cuisine. His new book, A New Way to Bake, which is entirely plant-based, is out on the 31st of August. Philip, welcome to Table Talk.
Thanks for having me.
Philip, we're going to start in the same place we always do, at the beginning, and ask you, what are your earliest memories of food?
My earliest memories of food are at my grandparents. My grandfather had a big sweet tooth. I think I definitely inherited that from him. And I just remember big family functions, big piles of food that everyone would prepare for a couple of days in advance, finished off with big platters of baklava and traditional Arabic sweets.
And you grew up in Australia, but you actually have Lebanese roots. Can you tell listeners about the story of your family and the journey across the continents and how that's affected the food that you eat?
Yeah, so my parents' family fled the war. There was the Civil War from in the 70s, didn't finish until the 90s, I guess. So my parents left in 72. And, you know, they made the trip from Lebanon to Cyprus, and then from Cyprus, Australia had a refugee program. They were encouraging immigration. And so, yeah, they made their way to Australia. It's interesting because they when I spoke to my grandfather years ago, and my father, they said that they never actually planned to stay in Australia. They'd always hoped to go back to Lebanon. But, you know, once your kids are in school and you start establishing a life, it becomes harder and harder to extricate yourself back to their home country. So, yeah, I was born and raised in Sydney. And I would say that Lebanese heritage is a huge part of my palate and of my experience.
And what sorts of dishes are the kind of classic Lebanese dishes that you might still eat?
Oh, so it's interesting because I eat everything, but when I'm feeling nostalgic, when I want a taste of home, it's always Lebanese. I mean, something as simple as hummus. I make hummus on a weekly basis. I soak chickpeas and blend them. I have to say the best hummus is that I've tried is at M. Sharif restaurant in London. Conveniently in Harrods, so I duck down to the food hall where they have a deli counter and take some of that when I'm treating myself.
And were mealtimes important to your family growing up? Were they a big occasion?
Yeah, they were. I mean, even on a nightly basis, I was, I guess, fortunate enough to have dinner with my immediate family. But then on weekends or in the evenings, I lived not only a few doors away from my grandparents' house, so we were always there. When my grandfather passed away, we continued going on a nightly basis to my grandmother's and spending time with her. We had this kind of, we called it the Salem Khoury Coffee Club. And it became this kind of meeting place of all of our relatives and anyone who lived nearby to come have a cup of Lebanese coffee, Arabic coffee, and bond.
And what about in life in Sydney? I mean, Australia and Sydney are both known for their great food scenes. What was it like growing up in Sydney?
Sydney and Melbourne have amazing food scenes with huge influences from everywhere, mainly determined by the, like anywhere, I guess, the migration patterns that happened. You know, we had a big Italian migration, a Greek migration. We had huge like Asian migrations. And then I think in the 70s, Lebanese, it continues in some way, shape or form, but all of this influences food and the types of food available. You know, I think in Australia, we have incredible produce from across the country. We have so many climates, and so you can get nearly anything at most times of the year grown in Australia. And we have, yeah, just amazing food that comes from so many different cultures. I always think it's we have really good food with really good ingredients and a taste of everywhere.
And did you go to restaurants much when you were a child?
As a child, yeah. My parents loved dining. They loved going out. I think they were taking us out to places from quite a young age. And I think that's definitely where some inspiration came for my interest in food, but I just never considered it a career until, I guess, a bit later.
And so what was the moment when you realized you wanted to go into the world of food?
So it's interesting. I always loved baking and I just never considered it a career choice. I always thought I was going to be a designer. So I went to university, did a degree in communication design. And then I think I was 21. I was working at a design consultancy, a branding agency, and taking in everything that I would bake on the weekends on the Monday. And my boss one day told me, hey, have you ever considered a career as a pastry chef? And I said, are you saying I'm a bad designer? And he said, no, you just seem to have a knack for it. And I never thought about it until then. And then I signed up for the course that students do when they become apprentices. So not something you might do when you're 18, but I was 21. Yeah, even as early as 15 years of age, I think in Australia, you can start an apprenticeship. I started that purely on a whim to learn more about something that I was passionate. Still didn't think it was a career, but I just remember feeling this kind of pretty magical feeling in that first lesson that I was in the right place and that this was the beginning of the next chapter in my story.
And that initial hobby baking, was that something that came from learning from family in the kitchen, or were you self-taught? Where did it come from as a sort of adolescent learning to cook?
I would say there were so many amazing patisseries that were just blossoming in Australia. We had this amazing culture that I think has died down in the last 5 years, but there was definitely a peak around 5 or 6 years ago of just incredible pastry chefs, you know, who'd worked in restaurants or in Europe and who were opening shops and doing amazing things. And I think it was just, there was such a strong culture, I think probably spurred on by things like MasterChef Australia, where it had spawned this huge interest in food and in dining. And for me, it was just another way of expressing myself. I am definitely a creative person at heart, and this was just another form of expression for me.
And tell us how you then settled on plant-based pastry. How did that develop? And well, and can plant-based pastry be as good as non-plant-based pastry?
It came quite a bit later on. About 5 years ago, I had a chat with someone, a friend, who was kind of like, I would say, vegan curious. And he said, oh, how about vegan desserts? By the way, at this stage in my life, 6 years ago, 5 or 6 years ago, I would never have understood what it meant to be vegan, why anyone would choose to go vegan. It was a completely foreign concept to me. You know, my food culture was very meat heavy, I would say. Eating meat was a sign of prosperity, that things were all right. So, you know, barbecues, it was just a big part of the culture. I would say that traditional Lebanese food is very much plant-based. There's a very strong culture of incredible plant-based food. But I guess there comes a point where, you know, the war is over. People are much more affluent and can afford meat. So the dishes that would traditionally consist of meat become more popular. And so in a way, the obsession with meat in Middle Eastern cuisine feels to me like a more recent thing. But going back to the plant-based question, my friend said, how about vegan pastry? And I remember thinking that it was just something that was impossible because everything is based on dairy and eggs, really. Like, they are a fundamental part of nearly every single recipe. You can't make a cream or a mousse or anything, a cake, without butter, milk, cream, or eggs. So for me, I just thought it also came at a time when I was working as a development pastry chef for Adriano Zumbo, who was an Australian pastry chef, doing really amazing. I mean, he's often been described as the Willy Wonka of at least Australian pastry. There's a couple of shows on Netflix. He was exploring, or together we were exploring, cleaner desserts. So desserts that might have reduced sugar or reduced fat, purely to be more better expressions of the flavors that they were saying they were. And so my interest in reformulation and tinkering with how things were made started there. I guess it started as a challenge because I just thought we were so terrible at catering for vegans that there had to be a way to do it well. I think from there my interest started.
So as you say, when you're looking at patisserie, it's all butter, it's all eggs, it's all milk. How do you go about sort of reframing patisserie in your own, you know, for plant? But you go back to the beginning, but how? What was your methodology?
So I think I'll speak firstly about the way that most would go about it. We have a culture of patisserie and cakes that has developed over hundreds of years based on, you know, if we kind of go back as early as possible, we have bread made from flour and water. Then we developed fancy bread enriched with butter, eggs, and sugar. We were adding honey, fruit to them. And then eventually the ratio started to tip over. And I think it was actually industrial America where like cakey cakes kind of really took off. And then in Europe or continental Europe, especially France, you had they discovered that eggs could be beaten to incorporate air, and butter you could do the same with butter. So we got to where we are for a reason. The eggs and dairy are in our desserts for good reason. But I think where it tipped over is where we became, you know, we have a culture where everything is accessible at all times. And for me, it started to feel like it was unsustainable. And naturally, I guess the inclination is to start substituting other ingredients in existing recipes. But for me, that looks like we're taking usually substandard ingredients like margarines, like more commercial or industrial additives and egg replacers and things like that to replace functions in traditional pastry. And I just thought that wasn't the way that I wanted to do it if I was going to do it. So it became more about reformulating. So when we look at something like, you know, the typical pound cake formulation is a pound of butter, eggs, sugar, and flour each. And so you have flour, which gels when you cook it. Eggs do the same. And actually, you need the equal parts butter just to tenderize that amount of, I guess, gelation that's occurring when you bake a pound cake. And so when you have to take out the eggs and replace them with something like water or milk, you don't nearly need as much fat. In fact, in that formulation, you can reduce the fat by up to 60% and replace it with something far more superior than a margarine, something like an extra virgin olive oil. And because you're using less of it, the flavor is perfectly delicious. And you have, a unintended benefit of it being slightly better for you. It's still indulgent. it's not health food, but you have a very comparative product, but just reformulated with excellent ingredients.
And is there any style of patisserie that you feel you haven't been able to turn into a plant-based version?
I would say that there are some, there's something like, there's two probably areas of pastry that I haven't grown myself into yet, at least not in a way that I would be comfortable expressing. They are, I guess, laminated pastries. And because you have butter is such a huge part of laminated pastry, we're talking anywhere from 35 to 50% of the recipe is composed of butter. And the other one is choux pastry, where it is very much reliant on the egg to perform the puffing function. So there are, I guess, two product categories that I am yet to do. And simply because while I could do them using other ingredients, manufactured or processed ingredients, I'd rather not.
You've worked under and alongside some incredible chefs. You mentioned Adriana Zumbo. You've also worked at Peter Gilmore's Key Restaurant at the Shangri-La Sydney. What have you taken from the chefs you've worked alongside during your career?
A lot in terms of, especially in terms of the way I view pastry and in terms of how I compose pastry. I think from Peter, there was such a huge emphasis on quality of produce, on good quality produce. I think that's where, you know, looking back, I realize everything was incredible. You couldn't ask for better ingredients, but it was like the 1%, you know, we were doing amazing things there, but it was such a small part of the industry in terms of like where food comes from. From Adriano Zumbo, I probably took the most. He's an incredibly talented pastry chef, incredibly creative and knowledgeable about how everything works. And so I think I took with me the rigor of developing pastry, knowing how to construct, what to construct, how all the components work together. There's this concept of the architecture of taste. So knowing what components you'd want to combine in order to build an experience when you're eating something. So if you think of like a mousse or a light cream will be the first thing that dissipates in your mouth, followed by something more unctuous or fatty, and then followed by the denser or crunchier textures, which are still left in the mouth. And so when you look at the different components and how they are consumed in the mouth, temperatures, all these kinds of things, you can start to build an experience, which is, I think, the joy of patisserie.
And Philip, you now work in Harrods, and Harrods is obviously a place known for its extravagant food halls. How have your plant-based patisserie creations gone down with the Harrods clientele?
Yeah, so the plant-based options are only a small part of what we do. I wouldn't say we're known for plant-based options, but I would hope that we're known for having very good plant-based options. The idea was always to have products where the fact that they were plant-based was just an added bonus. First and foremost, there had to be exceptional patisserie that anyone could enjoy. And so we learned very early on that when we labeled something as vegan, people just weren't interested because it was a bit exclusive. And so it only attracted people that were looking for something vegan. When we took vegan out of the title and put it in the bottom of the description as a kind of for your information or technical piece of information, more people were able to enjoy it. And we had like one dessert that went straight into a top seller almost overnight when we changed the label, and it remains in the counter actually quite a few years on. Yeah, it was a really interesting learning curve, because if you could develop something that appealed to everyone, everyone could enjoy, then anyone could buy it and enjoy it. And then you'd have, it was just another option for people who were vegan looking for something specifically vegan.
I think, I mean, I hope we've moved on a lot in this respect, but there are still a lot of people who are resistant to veganism, shall we say. Do you feel a certain amount of responsibility when it comes to the new book as to sort of representing plant-based baking and cooking and trying to convince people that there is merit in that?
Yeah, absolutely. I would say there's still an immense amount of stigma around vegan food, that it's somehow less than, or that it's more processed, or that it's, yeah, just somehow inferior. And, you know, I hate to say it, but it typically has been. That reputation wasn't earned for no reason. But I hope that we can move the conversation forward. And I've always thought that people don't know what they like until they've tried a good example of it. Or that, yeah, I guess it's, for me, yeah, it's a huge responsibility to showcase the best of what's possible.
And Philip, when you're away from work, what do you like to cook?
Definitely simpler things. I have a less is more approach. I think we get carried away with complexity. But I think even at work, though, we do try and say the most by saying the least. But that translates to home as well. But definitely simpler foods. I eat a lot of, I eat so much sugar and so much food that is just too indulgent, that when I go home, the first thing I want is a salad or nothing, because it just feels like I need to take it easy. And I just love freshness. I love fresh flavors. I love fresh textures. So it's always a salad. You know, I feel like I haven't eaten out in a while. A lot of time has gone into writing this book and then subsequently into filming every single recipe from the book. So yeah, when people scan the QR code, it loads a video of that recipe being made. And I thought that was really important because, you know, while the ingredient lists are very familiar, a lot of the approaches and techniques are quite new. So it was about just giving people absolutely as much as possible to succeed. And so that's taken a lot of time, filming and editing 80 videos in my home kitchen. Has been no easy feat.
And just to finish on, Philip, we always like to ask our guests what their desert island meal would be. What would yours be?
Probably a trifle.
You can have a main course as well if you want.
Salad followed by trifle. Or trifle followed by salad. I think that kind of sums up my...
And what's your ideal trifle? People have very, very strict ideas about trifles. What's your trifle like?
Yeah, you know what? Like, I'm not the hugest fan of saffron. My colleague Alistair Burt did a saffron strawberry trifle. I think it was inspired by the one that Heston does, but it was, you know, the classics. It was a chiffon sponge, actually. So incredibly light and spongy with a saffron custard, a kind of a mulled strawberry, a fresh strawberry compote, and yeah, a sherry whipped cream. And of course, the obligatory hundreds and thousands sprinkled on top. But yeah, it'd be that, I think. I enjoyed that too much a couple of Christmases ago. So I'm that's definitely one I want for my last meal.
You're taking that to the desert island.
Yeah, I mean.
I think that sounds like a very good choice.
Yeah, it sums up my, I guess, approach. It's always dessert first.
Well, Philip, thank you very much for joining Table Talk. And Philip's new book, A New Way to Bake, is out on the 31st of August.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for joining us on The Spectator's Food and Drink Podcast. For more recipes, food history, stories and drinks, you can head to The Spectator website. La pauvre fleur disait au papillon céleste, ne fuis pas, vois comme nos destins sont différents.